then we can get going. Okay. This is Dan Galadner, Wayne State University, AFT Archivist at the Walter P. Reuther Library, with Louise Sundin, April 30th, 2007, conducting an AFT Oral History Project. Thank you for participating in this, Louise.
Well, thank you for your interest. I think it's important that the AFT and Wayne State both have some memories that we can conjure up to instruct, maybe, mm-hmm. or at least inform the next generations of leaders.
That's what we're looking for. That's right. Why don't we just get started from where you were born and a bit about your family? And
I was born in Ortonville, Minnesota, and Ortonville, Minnesota is on the South Dakota border. It was my mom's home, and my mother and father were teachers, and both of them, they were teachers in Wilmer, Minnesota at the time, and my mom went home to have me during summer break, some vacation, and so I was born out there. I never lived out there. We were living in Minneapolis at the time because they had moved from Wilmer to Minneapolis so that my dad could teach in Minneapolis. At that time, it was a better pension because Minneapolis had a separate pension fund, and it was better salaries than out in greater Minnesota. So he was trying to move up in order to support his family. My mom decided that she was going to quit teaching while they had to raise their children. My brother John came along 4 years later, and so she was a stay-at-home mom raising us. And my dad, that meant my dad, on a teacher's salary of about $1,200 a year at that time, had to moonlight a lot. So he had, during the calendar year, he had three or four full-time jobs. He would teach a course all day long, and then he would go over to a large machine shop where he was a tool grinder and do the second shift, which would go from like 3:30 to 11:30 at night. And then in the summer, when he wasn't teaching, during the day he was a Brinks armored car driver. And one of the stories I kind of our family stories is that we'd always take at least a couple week breaks during the summer and go on a family trip in the car. And one time we went to Detroit, which was the headquarters of Brinks Armored Car Service. And Brinks in Detroit was unionized. The Brinks drivers were unionized. And so my dad stopped there and talked to some of the people there, and he had asked questions about their being unionized. And by the time we got back from vacation, that message had gone to the Minneapolis office, which was not union, and my dad was no longer a Brinks driver.
Yeah.
I still have his gun. And so then he, when he first came to Minneapolis, he was also a cab driver. And so he just did a lot of things so that my mom could stay home and raise us. And my brother and I both figure skated. Actually, my dad figure skated for a while. My dad was also president of the Minneapolis Figure Skating Club. We did a lot of family activities together. I remember the streetcars fondly and would love to see those come back. But that kind of the reality of teachers' salaries not being enough to live on was real for me from the very beginning. The other thing is that I think it was about 6 years after my dad began teaching in Minneapolis, they had a shortage of money. And it was at the end of the year, and the school board simply said, well, teachers, sorry, we don't have enough money to pay you, and so we're going to cut you 25%. Well, when you have that small a salary in the first place, and then you cut it to 25%, and at that time they had, by that time they were looking to buy a house and all kinds of other things, it's pretty devastating. So I always kind of say I was radicalized through genetics. Because I also had a Swedish grandfather who was an activist in the railroad engineers up in Duluth, Minnesota. He was with the DM&I, our railroad, Duluth, Mesaba, and Iron Range Railroad. And so he was an engineer on a train that went up to the iron mines and then took the ore back down to the docks in Duluth and, of course, out through the Great Lakes. And he was a grievance chair. And so I came by my union work honestly. He instilled that in his son, and that was my dad, and my dad always instilled in us the unionization that was the way to help workers succeed, and also this I got from him, the basic social justice passion. My mom and dad also were, I suppose you could say, victims of the rules or the unwritten rules or the expectations of teachers in those days, and that was that men were paid more than women and high school were paid more than elementary, although both my folks were high school teachers, and that women were expected to be single, and if you were married, then they assumed that you would immediately get pregnant, and then you got fired. So when my mom and dad were in Wilmer, Minnesota, they decided that they wanted to get married, so they went to South Dakota to an Indian reservation, the Sisseton Indian Reservation, to get married so that it wouldn't be a record in the Minnesota records. And that only lasted, of course, until she got pregnant with me. Then it became pretty obvious. But I just thought that was kind of interesting that they, those rules were, they tried to get around those rules that we, of course, did away with many years later because of the union. We had, in the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, we had several cases early on where women had been fired because they had become pregnant. And it was one of the many legal cases that we won on behalf of teachers, and many women got their old seniority dates back because of our action.
Excellent. Well, I assume your father was part of the MFT?
He was. And at that time, he was in a junior high school, and he taught ninth grade civics. And the junior high was the hotbed of the Federation. Although Local 59 had been was chartered by the AFT April 2nd, 1919, and Local 59, of course, is a pretty prestigious number in the AFT because it's the locals were chartered sequentially. And I think that Local 28 in St. Paul and Local 59 in Minneapolis are probably two of the two oldest, or at least I heard this one time, I'm not sure that it's true or not, but the two oldest locals that continuously paid their dues all those years. Others, for various reasons, you know, had a fit about something or stopped paying their dues for a short period of time or whatever. But so out here on the prairie, it always took us a long time to get the message about various things, so I guess we just kept paying our dues. But Local 59 has a really rich history, and so the when he joined immediately upon becoming a member of the Minneapolis Public Schools staff, he was in good company in those junior high schools. When I started teaching, I also was in a junior high school, and I taught ninth grade English my whole career. The English because of my mom, because she was a high school English teacher, and I think the ninth grade because of my dad. But when I got into that junior high, the very first day, of course, the guys who were the shop teachers all cornered me and said, "Well, you have to be a union member. Everybody in this school is a union member." And I said, "Well, actually, I already am, because I had joined as a student teacher."
Oh.
So I one-upped them, and I never let them forget that. But they were a pretty powerful bunch of guys, and they were great union supporters, and we had great times.
Uh-huh. What was the environment at the school at the time, working conditions?
The working conditions when I came in 67, I started teaching, were good because it was growing. The population was still growing. There were 66,000 kids in Minneapolis Public Schools when I started teaching. There are now 33,000, exactly half that. Hmm. But, of course, as we got into the late 60s, in 68, 69, 70, the students were all riled up, of course, because of the social conditions and the protests very shortly. It must have been about 2 or 3 years after I had been at Ramsey Junior High. There was a riot, a student riot. And so the first thing that I thought of is that I looked out of my window, and on the sidewalk there was a double column of Minneapolis police in riot gear with helmets and nightsticks in formation, ready to head not into our building but over across the football field to the high school. Because at the high school there was a young man whose father I had worked with a lot on desegregation plans and human relations activities, and his son had backed his car up to the school parking lot door and opened the trunk, and it was full of baseball bats.
Oh, geez.
And so he was handing out the baseball bats, so the police, and there was also a big fight out in the street, in the middle of the street, which was a busy street. So the police went over there with dogs and riot gear. But I remember so clearly looking out the window and seeing this double column of police officers, thinking, well, now what do I do? They didn't exactly cover this in my education classes at the university. So I took my desk, my teacher's desk, and I shoved it over in front of the classroom door so nobody could get in. And afterwards, my colleagues kidded me a lot, because they said, "Well, you darn fool, you know, you probably would have liked an escape route." But I think what I did was instinctively correct, because that's what they tell, that's how they train teachers now,
yeah,
is to barricade yourselves in and turn the lights out. And it's just unfortunate that that was kind of a precursor of what a lot of teachers do have to be trained in now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a pretty exciting welcome to the teaching profession.
Yeah.
The other thing is that when I was in 1970, April 19th, 1970, April 12th, 1970, we went on strike. And so I was still a probationary teacher, hadn't passed probation yet. but it was a strike that had been brewing for quite a while. And it was a strike that was bound to happen, so everybody who went on strike knew that we were going to lose our jobs, but jobs were plentiful then. They were hiring teachers, many teachers every year, because of the growth in the population. At our middle school, or our at that time junior high school, they it wouldn't be unusual to hire 20 new teachers a year.
Really?
In fact, our population was so big at that middle school, that high, junior high school, that we had some classes over in the high school, and the kids would go through a heating tunnel underneath the football field. There was a tunnel because it was the same heating plant, and so the kids just thought that was the best thing in the world, is to go through that tunnel.
Oh, yeah.
To go over to the high school to have classes. Anyway, we went on strike in April in 1970. It was the third teacher's strike in Minneapolis Federation of Teachers history. The first two my dad had been in.
So he was with the 48 strike?
He was with the 48 and the 51. And so he, in fact, in the in one of those strikes that he was in, it was in the middle of winter. And it was very cold. It was like, you know, 35 below zero. And so he went down to the Minneapolis War Surplus store, and he bought a complete flight suit from the where the Air Force had been in the Aleutians, and including the boots and the hat and the whole thing, so that he could be out on the sidewalk and do picket duty. So he did double picket duty for particularly, you know, people who, particularly the women who just, you know, got too cold.
Yeah.
And, or didn't want to, or whatever. So he, I still have that flight suit somewhere. And he had his picture taken in that flight suit. That's a prized picture of mine.
Yeah.
And he also, on those early strikes, I can remember at least on one occasion, I was pretty small. I don't think I was very much higher than the table, but he took me down to the Minneapolis Labor Center, and the it was called the Labor Temple at that time, which is gone now, to work on mailings and make signs and things like that. So he introduced me to that activity pretty early in my life. So he was in the first two. Actually, Local 28 in St. Paul was the very first teacher strike in the nation, and we weren't very far behind in ours. Theirs was in 46. Ours was in 48. So it was at that time, of course, when there were quite a few men teachers who were coming back from World War II. They got their teaching degree and license on the GI Bill, and they were coming into education and, you know, feeling that they pretty powerful and wanted more power and didn't like the school board, you know, telling them then oops, we don't have any money.
Right.
So it was a it was an activist time, and then in 1970. When we went out on strike, my mom was also on strike, and the school that she was at was a high school. It was the high school that I graduated from. She waited until my brother and I graduated from that school, and then she went back. She went back to teaching, and she was head of the English department. But I remember so clearly, she'd come home and she'd laugh because there were all of the coaches at that school. We're all members of the MEA, the Minneapolis Education Association, because we were had just won bargaining rights at that time, and the MEA still had a presence, and so she just laughed about how all of six of those big galoots, she called them, would all go to one of their houses. There was one of them who lived really close to school. And they'd all climb in one car and all go across the picket line, all in one car, all together. And she said, I was the only one out on the picket line, so I don't know who they were afraid of. But that I got really energized by that strike. I had my little kit bag packed and was actually hoping I'd get arrested. Right. You know, I was young enough to think that that was would be kind of a badge of honor. I never did, although I spent a lot of time standing in the driveway stopping Teamster trucks, mm-hmm. and we stopped a lot of trucks from delivering. And we had some of the folks at Ramsey Junior High crossing the picket line, and we took pictures of them, and we did all those things about... I remember somebody threw a pair of shoes at somebody, and I don't remember any more of that story. I'm going to have to ask somebody, because that pair of shoes was a big deal. And they made me park my car a block away from school, because at that time I was driving a used Eldorado, and they figured that was not a great symbol for teachers claiming poverty being on strike, so I always parked it a ways away. I also did extra picket duty. I went to elementary schools and did picket duty in the neighborhood where they didn't have enough picketers. So I did double and triple picket duty. I always say I was in the best shape of my life, because right. I just walked all the time. And we had a strike headquarters on our end of town at a church right across the street from our school, St. John's Church. And they opened their lower level to us, and that's where we made coffee and donuts and had donuts, and we all gathered. So we were always appreciative of that neighborhood church being sympathetic. And it kind of was an early sign that we now have the interfaith coalitions and with labor, and how important it is to have the faith community on your side. And we have some of our brothers and sisters in some of the other unions actually use the faith community a lot better than we do, because I think we went way too far over in education over to the side that said, you know, you can't even say the word faith or you're, right. you know, you're going to be unfair to somebody. So the hotel restaurant workers and SEIU and folks like that do a lot better job of using the faith community, although I do go on Labor Day to speak in pulpits through the labor faith collaboration.
So the strike was victorious?
The strike was victorious. I think there was a question. They tried to keep the schools open the first couple of days, but that was hopeless. And as the strike went on, of course, the politics and got involved. And it finally, I think, became obvious to the city leaders and also the community leaders who were on that school board at that time, that they had to do something about the issues that we were bringing to the table. And those were very different school boards back then. Those were school boards of people who were high in the community, leaders in the community. One was the Reverend Preuss, who was the leader of the Lutheran Church, and in the there was one who was a labor leader, but there was another one who was a big business guy in town. So they weren't the kind of parent activists, you know, coming up through the ranks of, you know, parent volunteerism that we have now. They were very different. And, of course, they were all pretty conservative.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a lot of friends on that board. We only had one. But finally, they decided that they would meet down at the Minneapolis Club, which is, you know, the inn club for business types downtown. And they were going to bring the negotiating team down, and they were going to meet with the board at that time. And it almost fell apart right from the get-go because one of the strong leaders in the union was Colleen Shepman, an elementary teacher who was, I think, elementary vice president at that time. And when they went to the Minneapolis Club, she was told that women can't come in the front door. Women have to go in, come in the side door. Well, you can imagine that Colleen, being the kind of person she is and still is, and the kind of leader, that almost killed it right there. But they finally did make concessions in the most and Colleen played a very strong role also in that. The staff and the board's representatives brought a tentative agreement to the negotiating team, and it did not bring anything that had that to address the main issue that the elementary teachers were concerned about, and that was elementary prep time.
Hmm.
The elementary teachers at that time did not have comparable prep time to high school teachers, because secondary teachers had a full, you know, 55 minutes of prep. Elementary teachers did not. And so that was really one of the, probably the main issue that the majority of elementary teachers were out on the sidewalk and carrying that sign, elementary prep time. Well, that first settlement offer didn't include anything to do with elementary prep time. So there again, Colleen played an incredibly important role in that she had a fit and said she wasn't going to approve anything that didn't include elementary prep time. That's why, you know, she was on the street. So I think they went back and revamped it. But of course, that was an incredibly important concept. It was way ahead of its time that elementary teachers would have comparable prep time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it did also is that it increased the numbers of teachers, because that meant that the school district had to hire elementary prep specialists who would take over the kiddies while the elementary teachers were preparing. So we gained this whole new echelon or new group of professionals who were who at various times are either phy-ed, art, music, science, technology. Now they've added technology, and those are teachers that are considered prep providers, and they go from class to class, or the classes, the teachers bring the classes to them, and they're the ones that provide the preparation time in the class schedule so that the teachers can have prep time.
Hmm.
So it also increased our ranks. We had, there was substantial salary increase and some other goodies in that settlement, but it was a real, it was a time that really kind of defined what I wanted to do in my career, and that was get involved in the union.
So this really sparked you then?
It did.
That's the spark.
It did.
You saw that you could do more with the union than just basic bread and butter.
Absolutely. And another thing that that people always kidded me about too is that at my junior high school, the Phi Ed teacher and I had the thickest files of anybody on the staff, because, God bless him, the principal at that time, Russ Brackett, was not too tolerant of those of us who didn't follow rules and regulations and didn't have our shades all even.
Oh,
and didn't have, you know, weren't always in the right place at the right time, and weren't standing by our doors during passing time. And sometimes, which I regret now, I was down smoking and things like that. So there were we, and the Phi Ed teacher had been there for years ahead of me, so I caught up really fast in having these memos in my file. So I decided then, too, that this was something that I needed to be involved in the union, because these files were just silly.
Yeah.
And it was all silliness. It had nothing to do with being a professional, and nothing to do with your teaching, and nothing to do with whether the kids were learning or not. It was all your paper on the floor and and shades at the right half-mast.
Right.
So I also led, I think, every protest at that school that there ever was, of course. Got teachers organized around issues. The next principal we had was the world's nicest man. He couldn't say no to anybody, so if a teacher went to him and asked him for money for something, and he didn't have it in the budget, he'd take it out of his own pocket and give it to him. But he wasn't a very effective administrator, and so I led the big march down to the school board meeting and made the speech that, you know, they had to get us a principal that was effective. And I think some people who, you know, loved him never forgave me for that. But it was that kind of activism also that spurned me on, that you can, you know, organize people and get them behind an idea or an issue, and they'd follow, and you could actually do something about it. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the very first time that I was going to get involved was that one of my colleagues, Gary Rogers, said, well, there's an opening here for the relicensure committee. Why don't you run for the relicensure committee? Well, I was naive enough at that time to think that there was really an opening. But I didn't realize at that time that there was an incumbent and everybody would vote for the incumbent and, you know, forget it. So I didn't win.
Yeah.
So my very first shot out of the bag, which was, I think, 5 years into my career, I didn't win. But that kind of inspired me to go on. This is a leap forward, but I'll tell you, while I think of it, the only other one I ever lost until the end was somebody at the AFT also called me and asked me to run for the national board, you know, for the National Board Certification Board.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that twice, and I got defeated twice. And finally, the third time, I started asking a few questions. And they said, well, you're running in the same category as Al. And I said, well, why didn't you guys tell me this? I wouldn't have felt so bad. Well, we just needed a name.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jeez.
So anyway, I digress.
But so, what was the next...
Well, the one more thing about teaching, and that at Ramsey Junior High, is that it became, because of the desegregation plan in the city, it became a whole ninth grade center while I was still there. So we had nothing but ninth graders, because there were three junior high schools that were put together, and the other two Bryant and Anthony were 7th and 8th grade schools. And then all the kids would go to Ramsey, my school, for 9th grade. Huh. So we had over, I don't know, it was about 1,200 9th graders. Jeez. All in one building all at one time. That was one of the best times that we ever had, because all of the teachers that we had at that time were really good teachers, and we were sure that we didn't ever let one single kid fall through the cracks, and we all had we liked each other, and we partied together, and we had, I was the social chair, we had great parties, and we had, it was just a good time in teaching. Now, I would say that the majority of those teachers, many of whom were young men, left to do something else because they just, again, weren't making enough money.
Right.
And so a couple of them went into real estate. A couple of them went into selling stocks and bonds to be stockbrokers. And I always felt so bad about that because, well, we've stayed in touch, but they were just such good teachers. By the same token, they were also very good real estate salesmen and very good stockbrokers. So they're doing really well now.
Yeah.
But it was a loss to the kids because they were really very good.
And the majority of the women stayed?
There were some women who left, but the majority of women stayed. Mm-hmm. And what's happened now is that the number of men in teaching in 2007 has gone down dramatically for the same reason. People can't make a living at it anymore. Mm-hmm. So eventually the ninth grade center was so successful, the district closed it. And they were trying to keep the population had started to decline at that point. And so in the early 80s, late 79 to 84, there was a precipitous decline in the number of kids in the city. Partly it was because of desegregation and families moved out. Partly it was because of a decline in the birth rate. Mm-hmm. But there was a precipitous decline, and in order to keep the high schools open, they wanted those ninth grade bodies, so they moved all the ninth grade bodies into the high schools, and our ninth grade center and our building was closed.
Hmm.
Then I went to Central High School, was one of the stars of the bright lights in the desegregation program. It was a magnet school, high school, and it was a great high school. People who had been there a lot longer than I had just loved it, stayed. And I chose that school specifically because it had windows, because I'm kind of partial to windows. And there are some other high schools in town that were built at times, you know, when they were built without windows.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Central was then closed. Dr. Richard Green, who eventually went to New York to be chancellor, had to close schools. And what his goal at that time was to close Center City schools and to force the kids and the families into the schools that were sort of around the outer ring of the city.
Hmm.
As another desegregation move. So when he closed Central and West High School and University High School and some of those beloved high schools, it was awful. He closed 17 or 18 schools all at once, and it was wrenching. And the worst part, I think, is that in order to sort of take the evidence away from the landscape, so people couldn't see
right.
their anger anymore, he had them bulldozed. And Central High School was the most beautiful school it was the oldest, but it was just beautifully built, and bird's eye maple flooring, and marble stalls in the bathrooms, and brass railings, and, you know, it was just, it was heart-wrenching.
Huh.
But then, of course, after all those schools were closed and were either sold, made into condominiums, bulldozed, whatever, then, of course, we got to the next, eventually, needing school buildings again. Population went back up because of immigrants coming in. And then they wanted to, Dr. Carol Johnson, who was superintendent at that time, and the Sharon Sales Belton, who was the mayor of Minneapolis, those two African-American women believed very strongly in having kids close to home in neighborhood schools. Well, where the majority of kids were, there weren't any school buildings anymore because they'd all been sold or bulldozed or turned into condominiums. So then that was a whole different strategy. They had to build all new buildings, and now it's going back the other way again. So these cycles are just are very heart-wrenching for communities, and we're going through it all over again.
Yeah, let's say it seems like it's repeating itself over and over and over.
It is, and then when Central was closed, then I had to leave there. So people were starting to think it had something to do with me. But so then when I went over to Southwest High School, which was the high school where I graduated from, my brother graduated from, my mother had taught. She had retired by that time. I had always kind of resisted going there because I just thought, well, my mom was such a good English teacher, I'd never be that good an English teacher. I'd pale in comparison. But I finally went back to Southwest, and that's where I taught in decreasing amounts of time as I phased out of teaching to my 30 years and then phased into the union work. Mm-hmm. I was elected in 1984. Well, first of all, before that, I was elected to the AFT Executive Council.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
I was trying to think. I think it must have been like 81, maybe, that I was elected to the AFT Executive Council. And in retrospect, I defeated I was chosen by the powers that be in the AFT to be the Minnesota vice president over the woman who had been in that position. But by that time, I had a pretty good resume, and I had a pretty good record of activism. Mm-hmm. And so I just decided that it was my turn. I think that was difficult for some people because it didn't feel that I was being very loyal at that time.
But you were asked, so you serve.
I asked, so I served. I applied and got asked, and I served. So I was on the AFT Executive Council. I was very active in, I think I was strike chair in the local in 82-83 when we almost went on strike. And we almost went on strike because the contract that was negotiated at that time was negotiated with a director of finance and a director of labor relations who basically, after the settlement, went back on their word and betrayed the guy that everybody really revered in the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. That his name is Norm Moen. Mm-hmm. And he was the staff guy who was negotiating the contract. And it was really hard for people to see that after the contract had been settled that there was betrayal. So that was part of what was going on. And we went to the brink in 83, did not go on strike. But by that time, I had kind of made a name for myself in speaking to the assembled masses in those strike rallies. And people, a couple of guys remind me always of my chicken speech that I called the school board chicken in one of those big speeches for the, I don't know, there are a couple thousand teachers at the Leamington Hotel, mm-hmm. which is now gone. So it was those rallies, I think, and my ability to organize and prepare for the strike that caused some people to then ask me to run for the local presidency. And so I ran against an incumbent, and that hadn't happened. I don't know that it had happened ever since Local 59 had been bargaining agent. And so we were always pretty peaceful out here on the prairie.
Yes.
But they wanted a president who was active. The president at that time was, his real love was the classroom, and he spent all his time in the classroom and spent very little time being president and really basically gave carte blanche to the staff. Mm-hmm. And the members of the executive board wanted a more activist president and somebody much more involved. And
well, this was the time to be an activist leader.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with Nation at Risk coming out.
Absolutely.
All that stuff.
Absolutely. So when I was elected in May of 1984, the timing was perfect in some ways to have a leader who had the background of being a part of the discussions on the AFT Executive Council, of sort of knowing what to do and how to respond. In 1984, then, the very first thing I did as president is that I started meeting with the superintendent and the board chair. And the superintendent was Dr. Richard Green at that time. And the board chair was Bunny Davis. And we just decided that we just couldn't continue providing what we needed to provide for teachers and kids and families in the city by having the open hostility and feud and open fighting between the union and the superintendent and the board. So we made a pact with one another that we'd start trusting one another.
Mm-hmm.
And
was this the committee of for professional teaching?
Well, that's what came out of that. Okay. Was our first activity.
Okay.
So the superintendent and I then decided that we were going to jointly try to lead an effort to professionalize teaching. So it was, you're right, the Labor Management Committee to Professionalize Teaching. The superintendent appointed half, I appointed the other half, and he also paid for 0.4 of my salary at that time so I could be released from the classroom, 0.4, to staff that committee. And that committee started doing a lot of things, but I think our first accomplishment was the mentor program. So we created the teacher mentor program, and it's gone through several changes and several title changes and iterations, but it still
you guys
exists.
Changed so many names.
I know, and so many acronyms. But
is this based on? Did you base this on Toledo's peer review, or
In a way. Not at somewhat, but our peer review system came later.
Okay.
And it's a different peer review system than Toledo.
So the mentor program, though, was...
Mentor program was, at that time, meant strictly to assist new teachers in their induction into the profession and into the city. And that, of course, was... something that I had become familiar with because of my activities on being on the AFT Executive Council. And of course, Al Shanker would bring in all these wonderfully provocative writers and speakers and researchers, and we'd have these great conversations around the table and debates, and they were pretty heated sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because the hardliners or the traditional trade unionists around the table were not exactly ready to embrace the professionalism.
Who was that? I'm just curious. I mean, I've read the transcripts, but I can't remember place and name.
Well, I think it took Al Fondi an awful long time to kind of get there.
I was about to say Al.
Yeah, and it took what was the name of the guy from Albany, New York? President of Albany for years and years. He was always a thorn in Al's side.
Oh, I can't remember. I'm blanking on the names.
Yeah, I am too, but maybe we'll think of it.
Yeah.
Of course, he was mostly upset because of the lack of process and approval that Al never got from the Executive Council before Al would go have a press conference and make these pronouncements about, you know, what the AFT was going to do and what it believed in the projects it was going to do. And then a month or two later, then we'd have an Executive Council meeting and he'd say, oh, by the way, you know. Oh, I almost had the name there. And he'd just have a holy fit. But being around that Executive Council table of the AFT was not just an education. It was also kind of an in-depth discussion around of the... Those of us who were around the table when the meeting was over, during the meeting, but then when the meeting was over, when we met in other venues, when we had local president's conference, we'd talk about these issues all the time and what we were trying in our locals, what we should be trying in our locals, what wasn't working in our locals, what was working. And so this rich, deep conversation would, and actually kind of, in a way, leadership one-upmanship. See who could, after every council meeting, we'd all run home, scurry home to our locals and see who could, institute what Al had talked about faster than the other one. But
right. Good, healthy competition.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, who'd get credit for it? That was even stronger. I will say that those of us out here on the prairie never got much credit for anything because our moms always told us that it was a sin to brag, so right. We always kept our accomplishments under a bushel basket. But
so the mentor program, how did your membership react to it? Positive, questioning, hesitant?
Well, there wasn't much to be... to be fearful of with the mentor program, because the mentor program at that time was peer assistance.
Okay.
And the review part hadn't started yet. So people were really glad to get the help. We had had an old helping teacher model that some of the old-timers remembered fondly. that there was always a helping teacher that would come and help them when they first started teaching. Hmm. Well, that sort of had, in the interim, had gone away. And so, in a way, it was a recreation, more formally and with training, of the old helping teacher model. It also caused us to start training teachers in peer coaching. So through the beginning of our peer coaching training to today, we've trained thousands of teachers in peer coaching so that they'd have the language and the skills to help each other, which I always say we don't, you know, pop out of the womb with skills about to help each other. We pop out of the womb being individuals, mm-hmm. and you know, not wanting to share our toys, so, or our knowledge or our skills. Right. So you really have to help teachers have the skills and the know-how and how to go into someone else's classroom, have a discussion with them, have that person help that person see what's going on in his or her own classroom, mm-hmm. help them, you know, articulate what they would like to improve, all that kind of stuff. Right. So we've been very diligent in trying to help teachers have those skills.
And was this put into the contract, or was this more of a policy set up?
It was put into the contract eventually. Mm-hmm. And I think everything that we can point to in Minneapolis that was our entire professionalism agenda, we all started with a labor management committee. Mm-hmm. And it all started being implemented through the guidance and development and leadership and implementation first, working out the bugs, working out the how it was going to be implemented. So it was always labor management that did that first. We'd put it in the contract after we'd sort of figured out how to do it and right. what ought to be in there. Hmm. So that was different than some locals did it. Some locals, you know, would rally the troops and put it out there and say, should we start to try this or not? Is it a concept we ought to embrace or not? And have a big, you know, a vote on it. And it's harder to do that because it's hard to embrace a concept when you don't really know what the details are, how it's going to be implemented, what it's going to mean for you.
Right.
So I just always thought that it was more important to sort of get it going, mm-hmm. and then it would garner supporters as it rolled along, which I think has proven to be true.
Kind of, it sounds more like more mature angle of instituting education reform in the new unionism, as opposed to old unionism, where, as you said, rally the troops. Get them behind you, mm-hmm. work on that. Mm-hmm. And usually you have that 10% that says no all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
But then if you've honed the language and the processes and the procedures and the personnel and everything, and then you by that time got it written up in a memorandum of agreement, mm-hmm. and then if that's working pretty well, first of all, you get it approved as a memorandum of agreement. It printed in the memoranda section of
right.
the contract. Then you put it eventually into the contract itself. It's gone through several votes, and it's less likely that a contract will go down because of a memorandum of agreement in the back of the book.
Right.
So it has gone through votes.
Uh-huh. Now, is this where the idea started with the 5-to-5?
Yeah, well,
and developed more into the professionalism that is now?
No. Actually, it started with the professionalism. And the early on, Dr. Green and I had hosted some meetings with leaders from the school sites. So, for instance, we co-hosted a meeting one time in which we had a dinner at the Calhoun Beach Club, which was a pretty fancy club. And it, we